Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this CCWG face-to-face meeting in LA day one session. I kindly remind you to state your name whenever speaking for transcript purposes and, of course, for the benefit of our remote participants. And, of course, remote participation is encouraged. We welcome remote participants to please have your voice heard through the AC room. We will be managing both face-to-face queue and AC room queue. So please do raise your hand if you are present in the room and you are also in the Adobe Connect room. Please do raise your hand in the Adobe Connect room so you can be put in the queue. Otherwise, we will be having quite a problem managing the queue. So please do enter to the AC room and raise your hand if you want to speak. We've gone through a couple of rules in our previous meetings. I believe we all are familiar with those rules. However, we would go through them very quickly. And it is very important for us to focus on what we need to do in this meeting. And I mean this by getting it right with regards to Workstream 1 and, of course, having a look at what we will be doing on Workstream 2. But one of the most important things for us to do in this meeting is to focus on the NTIA requirements and the CWG requirements. So I really encourage all of us to participate in an open mind way, in a positive way, in a constructive way, collaborative way, so that we are mindful of what we need to address before the transition takes place in order to meet these NTIA requirements and the CWG requirements. We would like to remind that all views are welcome. Everyone will have a voice in this room. We are all here together as stakeholders, so it is important that everyone is heard and that we have a respectful approach to everyone's points of views. Some of the rules, as I was saying, are openness, of course. The work will be based not only on the participation that we get here and through the Adobe Connect room, but also on the work that has been based or greeted or received greeting in our public comment. We need to focus on this second public comment period work. We need to finalize analyzing those comments from the community, received from the community, so we can build a better proposal for our delivery as a group. Let's keep the interventions concise and focused. Let's remember the rule on one topic per intervention as a best practice, and we do have a timer, and we know how to use it. So at a certain point, we may introduce this timer to keep interventions concise and short. This applies, of course, to the chairs and to the rapporteurs as well. Let's remember that day one and day two are different meetings. So for the purposes of maybe having to take decisions, if we do go into taking decisions, these are different meetings, so this will also be different readings. As I said, we need to focus on NTIA criteria. I see Eberhard, Lisa, hand is up. Eberhard, please.
Given that this meeting is very poorly attended and two-day meetings are one meeting, I object against having this counted as two meetings, and I object to any decision being taken as having read twice.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. Your objection has been noted. And while continuing on our focus for this meeting, I would like to remind everyone on the NTIA criteria that we need to address. And Brenda, could you please put on the next slide? These are to support and enhance the multi-stakeholder model, maintain the security, stability, and resiliency of the internet domain name system, meet the needs and expectations of the global customers and partners of the IANA services, maintain the openness of the internet, and our proposal cannot replace the NTIA role with a government-led or an intergovernmental organization solution. We also need to meet the CWG stewardship requirements, and let's hope we can find consensus across all the members and participants of the CCWG. As you know, we have two work streams, as I said at the beginning. Can we go to the next slide, please? And we will be focusing on work stream one issues. And just as per our charter, work stream one mechanisms are those that, when in place or committed to, would provide the community with confidence that any accountability mechanism that would further enhance ICANN's accountability would be implemented if it had consensus support from the community, even if it were to encounter ICANN management resistance, or if it were against the interests of ICANN as a corporate entity. So this important note at the footer, it is not restricted to whether there is direct impact on the INF function, consistent with the creation of the CCWG accountability in parallel with CWG stewardship. So with no further delay, I will now hand it to my co-chair, Matthew, for the next agenda item.
I'm happy to be your Mathieu, if you want me to. But my name is Thomas Rickert, for the remote participants, and Mathieu Weil actually can't make it for this meeting, but he's attending remotely, and he conveys his hello to all of you. I hope that we're going to have a very interesting, very fruitful session. And I think in terms of our dialogue, you will understand that we will try to be as inclusive as we can with remote participants. So let's make sure that all views are being heard. And in order to make it easier for the remote participants to follow, please do state your name and your affiliation when speaking. And we have a lot of board members here today, and we would like to encourage the board members to say so if they present a board view versus a view that they might have as an individual, because I guess that will help our group understand what the board's positions are and what the positions of individual directors are. We'd like to welcome you all. This is a very important meeting. We very much appreciate that you take the time to be with us for these 2 days. And before we dive into substance, we would really like to capture where we are at the moment. And while staff is going to bring up the slides for that, let me just be very clear that what we put in our report, and I think to a certain extent we have not fully accomplished signaling that, we are describing escalation paths. And this is perceived by some as us trying to attempt to turn ICANN's decision-making upside down entirely. So it will still be the board that is in charge of the operations. It's just to replace the U.S. government backstop for a limited number of powers that would allow the community, an empowered community, to step in and ask the board to redo certain decisions if, after a consultation process, the community's consensus views are not adequately reflected in the board's resolutions. So I think let's keep in mind that we are keeping most of what makes ICANN, the policymaking, GAC advice, all this will remain exactly as it is today. We're just adding a few bits and pieces in order to meet the requirements that have been put in front of us in order to enhance ICANN's accountability. So for this meeting, you know, we tried with the help of our friends from Xplain to set everybody's minds focused on what we're trying to do here. We recently closed our second public comment period. We have not yet conducted a full-blown analysis of all these contents, of all these comments, but we do have a public comment tool that where all the comments are put in and where a first round of analysis has been started by staff to help us seeing where we have agreement and where we need to put some more work on. So on the left-hand side of this slide, you see all the comments that came in, and actually the number is still growing. Fortunately, we had comments from China coming in, so it's good to see that geographic regions that have not been very dominant so far in this process are speaking up and making themselves heard. So we have all these comments coming in, and what we need to do now is keep an open spirit, keep an open mind, as we did after the first public comment period. When we presented our first report to the community, we got comments from the community. There were concerns by the community. We looked at that, we analyzed that, and we adjusted. But adjustments don't mean that you lose anything. We improved. And I think that's very important to note, that we are trying to be as good as we can with this exercise. So let's be open to all community input that we received and that we're going to discuss during these 2 days. We will speak about areas where we have support so far. So even if we've talked a lot about concerns and constructive criticism in the last few days, for most of the areas of our report, we do have significant community support. Let's not forget that. And if you look at the board matrix showing where the board is in disagreement with what we're doing, these are 4 points. Out of like 30, 40 points, 4 points. And if you look at those 4 points, actually it's 3 because there's one duplication in it. Right? So we think that we're in quite good shape to apply finishing touches to what we've come up with so far. There are important points that we need to discuss, but let's not forget how far we've gotten so far. Let's review the comments that we received. Let's try to better understand what the concerns are. And then let's try to take on board the best ideas. Again, let's try to not see criticism or the need for change as a bad thing to happen. We have put so many brains to work in the last couple of weeks. We had very high-quality comments, and we can now cherry-pick, which I think is a very luxurious position to be in. We can cherry-pick, we can take the best ideas of all the stakeholders and make our proposals stronger. Let's focus on requirements. There's been a lot of talk about different implementation models, and I would caution everyone not to be married to a certain implementation model. When this group started its work, you will remember that we looked at requirements. We established requirements that we see need to be met in order to enhance ICANN's accountability. And we said from the very beginning that as long as we come up with a concept that meets the requirements, the implementation doesn't that much matter. If your requirements are met, if concerns are removed, then there shouldn't be nothing to complain about. So let's keep that in mind. Let's work on requirements. Let's not discuss models, but let's discuss what we need to address, what we need to address now. We need to talk about prioritization in a moment. And let's focus on concerns. Let's make sure that the model that we're coming up with, a refined proposal, has ideally none, but if at all, as little unintended side effects as possible, as less risk as possible, because the least we want to do is destabilize ICANN or make ICANN worse than it is today. Not saying that it's bad now, but, you know, we don't want to have a negative spin on this, but we want to take things to the next level. And just as a reminder, we've confirmed this with Bruce Tonkin, who's our board liaison, who has said, yes, we're going to start the discussion based on the structure of our report. Remember, we had a public comment period on our report, and I think it would be very disrespectful of the commenters if we did not follow what we had in our report. And let's see what comments there are. Let's see what concerns there are. Let's see whether we can remove the concerns based on what's in the report, and where that is not possible, we need to rethink what we had in our report. Maybe some areas can be refined, maybe some areas can be rewritten, maybe some areas can be further clarified to remove concerns, because we need consensus on this. That's the most important thing. And then after having done that, we will hopefully come up with a revised CCWG proposal. Let's move to the next slide, please. That is the allocation of time and energy, as you can see there. I think what's quite usual in groups such as this is that everybody has his or her favorite topic, things that he or she thinks are very important, things that maybe the individuals have been working on as subgroup members, as pen holders of certain areas of our report, and they want this to become alive. They want to see this be part of the bigger picture. They want to see this being operationalized rather today than tomorrow. But what we think we need to do is look at the resources we have. We have limited time. We have a limited number of people. We know that people have day jobs next to this exercise. So we try to visualize this. We have 100 coins to spend. And so far, we may have thought that we can allocate 10 coins to 10 topics. But now that we see that we got comments on certain areas, that we got a blog post from Larry reminding us that there is more work to be done in certain areas, that means that we need to reallocate resources. The resources at our fingertips don't grow with increased demands or with an increased number of tasks. So we need to prioritize and make sure that we do the most important things first, and whatever we can do later, we should be doing later. You will remember that during last Tuesday's call, I've asked all of you to go through your requirements and score them, to find out each for yourself what's important and what you can do later. That's not that we're going to throw things under the bus. Everything's important. Everything's going to be dealt with at some point. But we have workstream one, we have workstream two, and maybe there are things that we can do at a later stage. That doesn't mean that it's less important, but we just need to make sure that we get the priorities right. Next slide, please. That leads us to the requirements. So we tried to visualize on this slide what the requirements are. We have three sets of requirements: NTIA requirements, CWG requirements, and our own requirements. And one thing's for sure, we need to make sure that we meet NTIA requirements. And due to the conditionality with the CWG and the conditionality of the charter organization's approval of the CWG requirements, we also better make sure that we meet CWG requirements. And then there is an extra set of requirements that our group came up with. So NTIA requirements, it's a must. CWG requirements is a must. So things that we might talk about in terms of prioritization are our own requirement. But if you look at what we've come up with and what the CWG is asking us to do, if you look at this, the colors used here, you see that everything basically that we put high on our list is requested by the CWG. The power to reconsider or reject the operating plan and budget, that's the CWG requirement. They've confirmed that in their public comment to our report. The power to reconsider or reject changes to bylaws, that's also something that they've asked for. The power to approve changes to fundamental bylaws, they've confirmed that this is something that they want. The power to appoint and remove individual directors is something that they want. The recall of the entire board is something that they explicitly mentioned as a must in their recent comments. So that shows that the CCWG's requirements are not, in terms of topics, going beyond what's requested by the CWG. Even they ask for enforceable appeals mechanisms, enforceable rights. We've double-checked that with their submission to the public comment period. So even though NTIA doesn't ask for enforceability, CWG asks for enforceability. So we need to carefully look at what the subset or what details of these requirements are that we can maybe discuss later. It's not going to be easy, but I'll encourage each and every one of you to raise their hand either here or in the Adobe room if you find a point that you say, but this is something that's not needed now. This is something that we should not erase from the list at all, but that's something we can do later. So whenever you identify something during these 2 days that you think we can afford to do later, please do speak up. Next slide, please. So these are the requirements, but let's now talk about where we think we're good to go or almost good to go. So we've come up with three different areas, and those that have attended last Tuesday's call will remember this. We have consensus on everything that's in the right-hand column. So I read out the list for you. So I read it out particularly for the benefit of the remote participants. And then let's please test with this group and confirm whether you think that this is okay. Because let's remember, the thorough analysis of the comments is still pending. So this is our initial assessment of what we got from the community. Existence of fundamental bylaws. Need core values with the balancing requirement. Principles of binding RRP. Again, this has been confirmed and asked for by the CWG. Standing panel and exclusions for a CCTLD. The principle of the five community powers. AOC reviews and their five-year frequency. Jurisdiction workstream two, and not focused on ICANN's headquarters, but rather on the applicable law for disputes and contract language. Standard bylaw change. There's principal agreement on that we need that. The existence of the community forum. Request for reconsideration. Reconsideration enhancements, and at staff to ombudsman. So these are the area where we got overwhelming community support. And if you think that, you know, there's something missing on this list, or there is something on the list that shouldn't be on the list, please do speak up now, because otherwise I think we should proceed on the assumption that these are areas good to go. Then maybe showstoppers is too strong of a word, but we have disagreement, or we have different views on the model, and most dominantly whether the community mechanism as a sole member or the MEM is the better way to go. Aaron Greenberg suggested sole designator model. So, you know, we have different views on what model is the best. And talking about the model is the area that is the implementation vehicle for what we're doing. And when we're going to discuss these 2 days, let us please all focus on requirements and concerns, and then the model will come quite naturally. So let's please all follow this. Let this not become a battle of models, and we apologize for the heading of the next agenda item having been misleading, because that sounded like we want to have a clash of legal arguments. That's not the case, and you will hear that in a moment. Then we have the budget veto. That's an area of concern. We need to work on that. And stress test 18 bylaw language is going to be an issue. We're going to spend a lot of time on those areas as we move on. So we're not going to discuss a lot on what you find on the left-hand side. These points are the points that we should resolve, where we should reconcile the differences. And on the right-hand side, you find areas that we need to discuss. But we think that these are areas that we can likely do offline in sub-teams. You know, they just need to mature a little bit more, but they don't show so many fundamental differences. And that's human rights. We know there's more work to be done in that area. Contract enforceability, enforcement capabilities in the mission commitments and core values, scope, standard of review and timeline, cost for the independent review panel, support of the AOC reviews by consensus, then the process for fundamental bylaw change, board removal and recall for cause or without cause, and then the question, do we want a workstream number two, or are we going to discuss the board's idea, which I think I can say that now, which I find quite charming, to attack those continuous improvements and put them into ATRT 3. And we can still hard code that into the bylaws so that everybody knows that these are going to be issues that are not forgotten, that are not being put on the back burner. But as I said previously with the coins, we can only do so much at a time. And I think that's the last slide, isn't it? So this is more or less to get everybody focused on what we've achieved so far. I mean, this left-hand column is quite impressive, isn't it? You know, so we have consensus on many areas that are important. What we're now going to do, and this is what we're, and I hope that you will all agree with us, and I would like to invite Rosemary and Holly to the table if you want to. We're now going to try understand the concerns coming from the ICANN board papers, because I think we really need to understand what the concerns with our proposal are and address the concerns. And I think there's been some confusion about what the motivation from the board was to come up with alternative suggestions. And we think the best way for us to discuss this is actually agree with the board on our correct understanding of where the concerns lie. And for that session to be chaired, I'd like to hand over to Leon.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Leon Sanchez. I see Sebastian Bachelet. No? Oh, do we have... So we have some queue already in the AC room. I apologize for overseeing that. So we have first on the queue, Avery Doria. So Avery, could you please take the floor?
Yes, thank you. Avery Doria speaking. I want to sort of question some of the ebullience of the left-hand column on consensus, because so many of those things are listed as principles of, which, without an underlying structure that supports them, are really words in the wind. So to say that we have agreement and consensus on those things, I really don't see that as more than a fantasy that makes us feel happy at the beginning of the meeting, because without the means to do them, we have consensus on nothing. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Avery. Next in the queue, we have Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. 2 points. Again, in the same gist as Avery's, we all agree on core values, but we don't necessarily agree on the specifics in the proposal, the wording of the core values. So that's a, you know, there's a conditional on what we're approving, what we're agreeing on there. And on the second one, the principle of the five community powers, some people word the powers differently. So the fact that budget veto is in the second column, some people take one of the community powers as budget veto, and they would say we don't agree on that. So there's some conditionals or parentheticals on the left-hand column.
Thank you very much, Alan. I think that the intent of the left-hand column is to identify common grounds that we have made a lot of progress in, and we have a general accepted consensus. But we do have an agenda that will go into addressing each and every one of the powers, each and every one of the core values, etc. So we would be, of course, deepening the discussion when we get into the specific point in the agenda later in the day. So next on the queue, I have Sebastian Bachelet.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I just want to raise here that I am not part of the consensus about the five community powers. You know that I disagree with the one on the budget, and I strongly think that we need to find other way to have to change the board members the way proposed. It's not a good one from my point of view. And my second point is that I would like very much that in a showstopper we talk about the model, and maybe we didn't list any of those models, because as you say that there could be a third model coming, and I would like very much that we focus on what we have done, but also of a good idea who can came on and build a new model, or a model we already discussed slightly. Then I would like very much that we don't put the brackets. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. We will be going into what you just said, and I would just like to remind that this is not a model competition, but rather a way for us to build the best model that we can for the future of ICANN and the future of the Internet. So next on the queue, I have Jonathan Suk.
I guess it's not a model competition, but it might be a model talent competition once we look at the requirements. I actually just wanted to speak back to something that Thomas said about prioritization, and it seems to me that one thing that might help be a clarifying issue is to reiterate what our criteria was for Workstream 1 versus Workstream 2, and that if we do that and change the vocabulary about it a little bit, or clarify the vocabulary about it, it might help to de-escalate some of the emotions surrounding it. So my recollection is that the criteria for Workstream 1 were the powers sufficient to ensure that the Workstream 2 reforms could be accomplished, and that was, in fact, the criteria for Workstream 1. So what's interesting about that is that it does help us to identify what the priorities should be in Workstream 1. It also doesn't suggest that those things are more important than the things in Workstream 2. They are simply the things that are necessary to bring about the reforms in Workstream 2. And I think if we maintain that clarification, we can make it less about using terms like pushing things to the back burner and things like that, which suggests that Workstream 1 is more important than Workstream 2, which isn't necessarily the case. It's literally about creating a baseline of community powers to implement the reforms as they evolve in Workstream 2.
Thank you very much for reminding us this, Jonathan. Next I have Cavus, then Nigel Roberts, and then Steve Crocker. So, Cavus.
Good morning to everybody. We need a little bit of a smile from the chair. Is it too serious? Yeah, that helps. That is experience that I have with a little bit of relaxations we could achieve more. I don't want to get into the detail of the issue. I want to share with you some of my experience working with you, and I'm very grateful that you allowed me to join your group and share whatever I could with you. Let us start with the accountability. NTIA was the first such accountability to transition. So there is no doubt about that. If you look into the process, we should present something to NTIA which convinced NTIA that satisfy the requirements and they could take it to the upper level if it is a process in order to be approved by the authorities that transition would take place. Let me tell my experience that I don't think that NTIA would be any position to take alternative proposals or consider alternative proposals. They presented it back to us saying that doesn't work. So we should have an agreement with each other. We are grateful to the board to making every effort and providing these very valuable documents, which help us to understand. The problem that they raise in general is the implementation problem. I remember one of the very high-level meetings of the other organizations. There was a plenary of the conference decided on something, and the chairman of the board of that executive body said, "Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I can't implement that. I have difficulty to implement that." So something which is not implementable or has problems with implementations need to be looked at. We have to put our thought together to find out, without any compromise to the quality of the objectives, to see whether there are other ways and means to achieve that objective which is more acceptable to the entire community, including ICANN, and a proposal acceptable to NTIA. I can raise a very important point and saying that you are changing the governance of the situations, going from the current situations to something which is a voting process. It may make difficulties. While they accept all objectives, they propose alternative methods. I think we have to carefully look at that one, and if it is achieving the objectives, we should take it. If there is some rooms of improvement, we have to do that. But currently, the way that we have proposed this voting procedures in community empowerment would have some difficulties. The second area of difficulties is the budget and strategy plan that they face difficulties, but they propose something which is close to us with a different language, and I think we could have some achievement on that. They did not talk about the forum, but I don't think it is a major problem. At this stage, they don't want to discuss this work stream too. I don't think that is the major problem. we could high-level reference the work stream too. But what we have to do, we have to work on what is the minimum requirement for the transition. Something that we cannot compromise is the requirement of CWG. We cannot compromise. That is not subject to any discussions. That requires budget, removal of the directors, and bylaw. By bylaws means fundamental and standard bylaw. I don't think that the board's proposal has any difficulty in those areas except the budget. We could come up with that in another alternative ways. So, if we look into the diagram that the board provide to us, A1 or 1A, they have agreement with what we have said. 1B, they have agreement with some improvement and comments. I think we should agree. There are three areas they have disagreement at this stage. One is the mechanism. Instead of this sole member, they want to have MEM.
Cavus? Excuse me. We're going to discuss all the sections.
No. 2 minutes. Let's see that we don't go to the... We go to the... What are the areas that we have problems? These are the three areas. Mechanisms, budget, and accessibility and cost. That is what they put two. That means they have to have another alternative, or we have to have another alternative. So let us look into the areas that we have difficulties. The area that we have improvement, we can do it with some discussions. So let us concentrate on the area of difficulties. And the first one is the mechanism, MEM or sole member or between the two. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. I think that Thomas was clear on how we will be addressing each of the issues that you very valuably just raised. So next in the queue, we have Nigel Roberts.
Thank you, Leon. My name is Nigel Roberts. I'm a CCNSO councillor from Europe. Most of you know me in the context of the CCWG as a participant and also in the context with Leon of facilitating the work programme for work. But at this meeting, I'm a member. I'm the alternate for Mathieu, though I'm grateful to the two of you not to have the co-chair responsibility. My colleague, Stephen Deerhake, who is sitting next to me of the American Samoan Registry, is here as the alternate for Giovanni Seppia. I hesitate to overuse the word objection. We've heard plenty of that on other occasions. But I must say that we're not in agreement regarding the triage that I see on the board. I know we'll come to it in due course, so I don't want to dwell on it at this time. But the question of ICANN's acceptance of fundamental human rights is more important than just other issues. And I want to place that marker down right now, if that's okay.
Thank you very much, Nigel. Your comment and observation is well taken into account for our work later today. Next on the queue, I have Steve Crocker.
This on? Yeah. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opening comments, and I appreciate Cavus' very cogent comments. I want to draw attention back to the question of the commitment to Workstream 2 issues, and particularly if there are elements that are moved from Workstream 1 to Workstream 2, what is the level of assurance that they will be carried forth? We've had some caucusing about that. Let me call on my colleague, Chris Despain, to speak as part of my intervention here. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve. Chris?
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Just to try and briefly address the what we're calling the Workstream 2 issue. It's covered briefly in the last paragraph of our comments, but in essence, it follows what was originally discussed in this group quite some considerable time ago. And the way that it works is this. First of all, it doesn't matter for the sake of this discussion what you put in Workstream 2 for the moment. That's a separate point. It's a process for dealing with stuff that happens in the future. And there might be a Workstream 2 or a Workstream 3 or a Workstream 4. It's a process for continuous improvement. And the goal is simply this. You write a fundamental bylaw that enshrines the process, whether you call it ATRT or you call it something else, it doesn't matter, enshrines the process and says that the recommendations that come from the process, so CCWG2, son of CCWG, etc., would be treated by the board as you know, recommendations from the whole of the community. You would probably need to put in a high threshold. You probably need to put in the ability to not implement them, but you might put that up as high as 75% or around about there. And then what you do is you rely on the powers that have been created in Workstream 1 to force the board to actually implement if they refuse to do so. So in simple terms, you go through the process. It comes in with a series of recommendations. For some reason, the board says no. And if that happens, the community then triggers its power to spill individual members of the board or spill the board, and that in itself gives you the ultimate enforceability. And in fact, in respect to the MEM suggestion, and it may well be the same in the sole member model, I don't know, you would also then have the ability to refer that refusal to arbitration based on the principle that it was the board refusing to follow its fundamental bylaws. So in essence, that's the proposal, and it seems to me that that process creates the ability to give the SOs and the ACs the comfort that they should need. That stuff that is going to happen in Workstream 2 and 3 and 4 will actually be dealt with. And in essence, it's what we discussed right back in Istanbul, if I remember correctly. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chris. As you were called by Steve as part of his participation, I would like to just ask if you have anything else to add, Steve.
No, thank you. I want to adhere to the single topic per intervention, and so that was what we had in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. So we still have a queue, and I'm closing the queue right now so we can go to our next agenda item with Steve Dolbianco. That's where I'm closing the queue. And I see Jonathan Sukhandis up in the AG room.
I won't take long. I guess, again, just to correct our vocabulary, I don't think there's any assurances around Workstream 2 or 3 because it will be back in the responsibility of the community to decide what the priorities are, to decide what reforms need to take place. So, I mean, that's the point. It's about empowering the community. Somewhat like Chris said, I don't know. Part of what we'll need to do is decide what sufficient empowerment represents. But that's really the issue. It will be the community's responsibility, not the board's, to make sure that the reforms in Workstream 2, 3, and on take place.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I would just like to remind us all that the board is also a part of our community, so I wouldn't like to draw that dividing line between board and community, as we are very well aware that board is chosen by the community and it's also part of the community. Next in the queue, and finally in the queue, is Steve Dolbianco.
Thanks, Steve Dolbianco with the Commercial Stakeholders Group. I'm intrigued at the idea that the board came up with of assuming that it's an ongoing process of improvements. And I'm intrigued with the notion of having that be the ATRTX, whether it's 3, 4, 5. And to make that happen, in our proposal, we bring the ATRT, which is currently only an obligation of the affirmation of commitments, we bring it into the bylaws so that it has permanence, number one, and we try to give it more teeth in the sense of its recommendation. But if you'll recall, we've stopped short of saying that the board must implement the recommendations coming out of an ATRT. We were advised that we couldn't obligate that because it would cause a binding result would cause the board to potentially violate its fiduciary duty if it had to implement the recommendations coming out of a team. However, we did say that if the community disagreed with the board's decision not to implement a recommendation out of ATRT, that we could invoke an IRP or a reconsideration, and the results could be binding in the case of an IRP. So that if we think we can put all of the later items to future ATRTs, we should do so either with the reliance that they wouldn't be binding, or if we believe there are certain items that must be binding, we have to go to the recommendation that Chris Despain mentioned a few moments ago, where there may have to be a bylaws change in the transition, delineating the specific items that a future ATRT could bind the board to implement. But in a simplest case, to keep things simple, an ongoing process would say the community will determine, as Jonathan Zook said, the community determines what its priorities are. It takes roughly a year to do an ATRT and a couple of years to do the implementation. And if at the end of that cycle the board has refused to implement or implemented improperly one of the recommendations, we do have a tool at our disposal called the Independent Review Panel.
Thank you very much for this, Steve. So we'll now move for our next agenda item, which was originally labeled as the review of the memo prepared by legal counsel in comparison with I'm sorry, what was that? I'm sorry, TJ, I'm not getting what you're trying to tell me. I'm sorry.
I see Steve Croker on the queue.
Oh, I think that's an all hand. Is that right,
no,
Steve?
I wanted to just reply.
Okay, just go ahead. Thank you, Tijani.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I've been involved with ATRT1, ATRT2, and if I might, I just want to add a little bit of color and detail on how the process works and what the issues are with respect to the relationship between what's recommended and what actually happens. First of all, as a top-level statement, we take the recommendations very seriously. It is not the mindset, even if there were no rules around it, is that whatever is produced in these recommendations is taken as the default of this is what we should do. And if we were to come to a decision not to accept any of the recommendations, we would want to go through a very careful reply and analysis and engagement on what the reasons are, what the rationale is, and to sort that out. So that's as a top-level thing. Main reason I wanted to say something, though, is to get at the next level down. We take advice from a number of different sources. We take them from the affirmation of commitments reviews, from experts, from the advisory committees, and so forth. Our general process is to do the following. We take the advice, and the first question we ask is, do we understand it? And amazingly, not every single piece of advice is clear in the way that it's written. The second thing we do is we say, okay, if we were going to go forward with this, what would it take to do that? How much would it cost? Who would be responsible for it? What is the basic work plan look like? Not in detail, but just roughly. Is it feasible? And that is information that I think is fundamentally necessary from an operational point of view before taking a decision as to whether to implement or not implement, whether to accept the recommendation and implement, and also whether or not there's any issues with respect to how to do it compared to what's expected. At that point, we have enough information in hand to make a formal decision. And as I said, the bias is strongly in favor of yes. And if we say yes, then we have to put in place the actual execution, and we have to instruct staff to carry this out. Now, some of the recommendations are not entirely accomplishable within staff. They are recommendations that apply to other organizations or other components of ICANN, and so that raises somewhat different issues about whether or not it's possible to carry that out. We have not been perfect in all of this, I will say quite forthrightly. And it is a major part of our agenda at the board level to improve the execution of this, to improve the visibility, and to improve the accountability. And we've been working incrementally, not fast enough from my point of view, but incrementally, to get this process up and running in a way that is clearly trackable and visible. All of this is a part of, as I said, what our commitment is in advice from all quarters. The fine, I think, is common sense, is that advice from any quarter, whether it's Workstream 2 or affirmation of commitments or from advisory committees and so forth, if it is couched and expected that anything that is advised, whatever the recommendation is, has a binding requirement, misses the evaluation process, the feasibility, other aspects, which are part of sensible operational responsible execution, responsible oversight of the operation. Under no circumstances would a decision not to do something be based on arbitrary or undocumented judgment. Our mission at the board level is to make sure that the processes are carried out in a visible and sensible way, and that, as I said, and I'm emphasizing it repeatedly, that in the event that we want to say no, or that we want to say, but here's an issue, or that we want to say, here's another way to go at it, it's a rather important and implicit part of the responsibility to explain and to engage, because our posture is that we're trying to convey information that is necessary and would be seen by anybody else, not just arbitrary judgment on our part, that if the people who are making the recommendation were sitting in our seats, they would have the same set of issues to grapple with. So I wanted to raise that aspect, the operational digestion process, if you will, what happens after advice comes in and what's necessary to happen. Our commitment, as I say, is absolutely to make it happen unless, and then the unless has a very specific set of criteria. If it's not feasible, if it overruns the resources, if it has other serious problems. But with that comes the obligation that we explain it. And then further, if we do say yes, is to actually make it happen. And I well understand, probably as well as anybody in the room, that the actual execution that we've had in the past is not a black or white situation. We've done a lot of work. We've done many, many good things. But it certainly could be improved, and that commitment has been in place and is in process. And appreciate the sentiment that stronger enforcement of this is desired. And I don't have any fundamental problem with the intention of that, but I think it would be a mistake to say we'll simply make recommendations from any source, including Workstream 2 or including ATRTX, binding in the sense that what's written there becomes law. What's written there becomes a recommendation, and it has to go through this process. And I've got no problem if there is recourse mechanisms, IRP and others, attached to that. It's perfectly sensible. But in those recourse mechanisms will come up the issues of feasibility and what the judgments are and so forth. Sorry to go on at length, but you can tell that this is an area that I've both thought about and I'm quite invested in. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very comprehensive and thoughtful explanation, Steve. So we will be going into the next agenda item, and it was originally leveled as a comparison between models. But instead of that, we asked our lawyers to not do a comparison, but instead try to categorize the different comments that were received in the second public comment period into three main categories. The first one being those comments that do have a very valid point and we definitely need to consider and address in our next version of our document. The second category being those that raise concerns that are compatible and can be addressed with the model as it stands. And the third category being those comments that are in some way incompatible with what the community and the working group has proposed in its second draft, and that would, of course, need a deeper reflection, a deeper analysis on how we could address those issues. So, as I said, we're not trying to carry here a model competition, and I would like to invite you to think of this exercise in a technical analogy with regards to open source software. We're not speaking about proprietary models here. We're not speaking about proprietary software. Instead, we're trying to reach an open source solution that, as Thomas said in the beginning, we are trying to cherry pick the best parts of each of the proposals, of each of the comments, so we can have the best solution available for the future of ICANN. So the memorandum that we received and that is in our reading list is, of course, a reference to help us move forward, but it's not the point of discussion at this stage. And I would like to invite you to have this as a listening session for our lawyers, as we will be addressing and going through each of the many details on what they will be commenting further or later in the agenda as we go through each of the points of our agenda. And I would also like to acknowledge that we have council present. Of course, we have Rosemary and Holy Gregory with us, and we do also have ICANN legal staff. I see Samantha at the back, and we also have JJ at the left side of my left side of the room, your right side, of course. And I do believe that we have also Jones Day attorneys here. And okay, so we have her here. And I don't know if there are any other, I would say lawyers, but then we would be love between lawyers. So external counsel. Do we have any more external counsel here? So just
we have external counsel that haven't been introduced from Sidley and also from Adler. From Sidley, we have Ed McNicholas, and I'll let you introduce your colleagues.
From Adler, we have Greg Colvin and Stephanie Pettit.
Thank you very much. So now we all know who are the lawyers, the external lawyers in the room. So with no further delay, I will hand the session to Holly.
Thank you very much. And I hope you don't think that by the great divide that we lawyers are really all that divided, because I think you'll hear that we're really not, that there are not great legal disagreements between the legal teams. A neighbor of mine passed away this week. I live in Montclair, New Jersey, and Yogi Berra lived in Montclair, New Jersey for many years. For those of you who may not follow baseball really closely, Yogi is a very famous catcher, manager, coach, who's also famous as a bit of a philosopher. He was very famous with little quotes that were a little bit missayings, if you will. And some of them come to mind this week as we think about his passing that I think we sort of relate to what we're talking about here. And one of them is that if you don't know where you are going, you might wind up someplace else. So I was thinking, as Thomas was talking about the need to make sure that we focus on requirements and concerns to come up with the model rather than vice versa, because we need to really know what our requirements and concerns are to sort of know where we're going. He also said, in theory, there is no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. And I think that's a great reminder that we have to come up with something that works in practice. And so we have to be mindful of theories, but we also have to really think about how things work in practice and the stress testing. And finally, he said, it ain't over till it's over. And I think we're all experiencing that. We've got more work to do. We'll continue to work in good faith, and we're valuing this experience of working through consensus. Now, we've provided you with materials that analyze the comments from the board in relationship to the sole member model. And I think there is a fair degree of agreement around community powers, but the different emphasis on enforcement and the legal structure gives rise to some important and nuanced differences in how those powers are effectuated. We really want to emphasize a couple points at the outset. We, as lawyers to the CCWG, are agnostic. We don't have a view about the best model for you. We've been listening to what you want by way of community powers, and by what you're telling us you want, where you want to be on that trust versus enforcement continuum that we've talked about. And we've tried to help you come up with a model that will reflect what we've heard from CCWG, where you want to be. Now we're getting comments in from a broader range, the board and others, and it's very important now to go through those and sort of test where we are, where you want to be as we think about it. I said there are really no fundamental differences regarding the legal rules that apply and how the legal rules apply, but as you know, different legal structures result in very different strengths to the community powers. And we've counseled you from the outset that the law provides a fair degree of flexibility. So we think we can help you build whatever it is you decide you need. There are twists and turns, and some things become more complicated. Some powers become indirect rather than direct based on some of the choices that you need to make. And you're all familiar with this because we've been working on it for months. And, you know, I think you're all very well grounded in these concepts. You will have to decide how much certainty is necessary with respect to enforceability of community powers. Now, rather than focus this discussion on the legal models and you know, how they impact the various proposals, we thought it would be helpful to share with you, as we're reading this set of comments, sort of the underlying concerns. Because I do think that Thomas and Leon and Matteo are right, that if we can articulate the underlying concerns and think about how to best to address it, we don't maybe need to get all wrapped up in is one model better than another model. So we thought that we would start there. We will then try to focus on some of the areas where we think there's some easy wins, and then some of the things that might be a little bit more difficult to do. But we haven't really categorized them in the detail that Leon suggested we might have, because we got that assignment very late yesterday afternoon. But we can help maybe with that discussion develop that throughout today. So in terms of the key concerns, one of the key concerns that's very apparent is concern about the degree of change that's required to convert to a new accountability model, both structurally and from an operational corporate governance perspective. And I want to suggest that that's a concern that underlies any shift to any model that's different. Whether you remain with a very board-centric model in an environment post-NTIA, or you go to a membership model, or you go to a designator model, this is going to be an issue. There will be some change. I think change is always scary, and I think part of the task here is for us to do a better job at articulating what kind of change is necessary. Some change is structural, some change is in a decision model, but some change is also a little bit cultural. And part of the thing here is to make sure that the valued culture around consensus is maintained. Another key concern that comes through is the degree of experience and community preparedness to take on a new role in holding the board and ICANN accountable. I think that looking around, this has been a valuable experience and adds to the community's experience level in that regard, but it's something that we certainly need to be aware of and consider. Another key issue is to assure that the SOs and ACs are accountable in their use of new community powers. What are we going to do to make sure that whatever power is given to the community is used in a responsible way? And there are some legal mechanisms we can used to help this. This can be talking about how great the level of consensus needs to be for various kinds of powers, and who participates and how you make sure that you've got a broad group of participating and that SOs and ACs are not captured. How should community decisions be made? This is an area that I think we've heard great concern around sort of the voting mechanism. And is that voting mechanism really different from the consensus mechanisms that the community currently uses? And if so, will there be unintended consequences around that? I think that's an area where there's a lot more work to be done. And what is the relationship of community voting to consensus development? And is voting inconsistent with traditional ICANN decision-making processes? There's another issue that's embedded in that concern about voting, and that's about the allocation of power among community groups. And is it sufficiently inclusive? For example, if some groups like the GAC prefer to remain in an advisory capacity, is their influence diminished? You know, how do you address that? These are very legitimate concerns that certainly are raised and on the table. How do we assure that community powers are implemented in a way that avoids any paralysis to the board as your fiduciary? Now, I come at this as a corporate governance lawyer. My whole practice is in advising boards of directors and companies and shareholders and membership groups in thorny situations. And I always start with the notion of we really need role clarity. The most important thing in a governance structure is to know who has what rights, how are they exercised, what are the roles and responsibilities. And we have to be very clear. Now, here you already have this notion of kind of some sharing, some consensus developing, and shared power. Any clarity we can give to that is important. But there is a concept, and it's a very important concept in all kinds of corporate law, for not-for-profits as well as for-profit entities, that the board is charged with directing and managing the affairs of the corporation, and the board are fiduciaries. And they need to be able to have a fair degree of power as fiduciaries to do what's in the best interest of the corporation. I think we have to be very clear about it. We've talked about this concept a lot. It's important that you don't bind the hands of the fiduciary. One of the reasons that we centered on a member structure is under California law, you can give things like some budget oversight powers to a membership body without impairing the board's fiduciary ability, and you can't do that to third parties. So as soon as we start talking about giving some budget veto to something that's not a member, we run into some struggles because courts are very hesitant outside of a member to constrain a board. So, you know, that really is one of the big issues when we start talking about the board veto, and one of the reasons we centered on a member model, we're not, you know, certainly you don't need to be wedded to it, but there are trade-offs. You know, I was thinking in some ways this is a little bit like we've got Jell-O, and you push over here and something moves over there, and trying to keep it all together, it's a very complex kind of system that you're creating. How do we assure, this is a really important one, a big concern, how do we assure that any exercise of statutory powers is appropriately constrained to avoid unintended outcomes and capture by a group that does not reflect community consensus? This is a big issue, but it's an issue that can be addressed and solved for, and we have some ideas about how to do that, but we think it's very solvable. It sounds scary that a member could dissolve the corporation. There are ways to put in thresholds and protections so that that eventuality essentially would not happen. And it's a pretty simple thing to do. And I think a big one, how do you assure that community powers are enforceable without leading to undue litigation? Nobody wants to think that we're creating a model that's going to result in people running to court all the time to enforce community rights. That's exactly what we're hoping to avoid. But sometimes if you have clarity around enforcement paths and escalation paths, and everybody clearly understands it, it helps people come to agreement. And that is certainly the hope here. So these themes from the comments are not new. They're all things we've been considering and discussing at great length, but clearly there's more work to be done. The feedback from the comments suggests that there's more work to be done in a couple of areas. There's one group of things, I think, that's really about better communication about what you've considered and why you've come to a decision, what was on the table that you've sort of decided a pathway not to go, and the reasons for and why you've decided to go in a particular direction. To me, those are sort of communication issues. The harder issues is also undertaking to assure that a concern is addressed through additional processes. And there are a number of issues where we do need to work on additional processes. I'm going to turn over to Rosemary now to talk about some of the examples where we think there's, you know, more work to be done and greater clarity that could be had. And then I think we're going to try to get us back into the right time frame. The chairs have asked us to try to not take our full allotted time so that we can use this time for real discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. We didn't have a lot of time, as noted. This assignment came to us last night, so we're trying. While I was still on a plane, I got a little bit of a briefing. So if these are a little off point, it may be due to that. We tried to come up with some examples of the themes, how we might resolve some of the themes, or more specific concrete examples of the themes that Holly just talked about. And for example, it's pretty clear that there isn't enough of a description in the CCWG proposal for all the places where you actually do contemplate community discussions. This came up in talking about the community forum. What kinds of consultation or collaborative process might go on with respect to changes to fundamental or standard bylaws or the budget veto. So I think that's a communication issue, where I think our impression is that the CCWG intends a lot of that, and it didn't quite come through how much you believe that has to happen, and maybe it needs to be made more concrete rather than just an aspiration and put in as a process, perhaps. Another area where clearly more work does need to be done is on the IRP. Everyone seems to agree that more work is needed on the IRP, including the CCWG, so that won't be a surprise. I think there's agreement on the need for the independence of the panel. There is some lack of clarity about when and how the IRP should be binding with respect to some of the community powers. I think there needs to be a little more clarity on standing based on some of the public comments, on who absorbs the costs, and on what prerequisites there might be for going to an IRP. This gets into that concept of there being an escalation path and knowing which items are on the path and which are a separate alternative mechanism. The thresholds for community decisions were specified in the CCWG proposal, and somewhat differently, other proposals have been made. I think there's room for revisiting those to see if you're still comfortable and whether some might need to be raised. I don't know if any need to be. I don't know if there's been much for lowering them. Perhaps there has been. I don't remember all the public comments. But that is one of the ways, for example, as Holly mentioned, this concern about statutory powers. In addition to the enumerated community powers, there's been a lot of concern voiced about these other statutory powers that members have, and one of the ways to address those, which we really haven't discussed, but I think certainly has been in the lawyers' minds for a month or two, is that we probably would want a statement, if we were to stay with a member model, that any power that is not one of the enumerated community powers needs to go through a super, maybe even a unanimity standard before the member could exercise that, effectively making it perhaps impossible. If all you need is one vote against it, the chance that, you know, you won't get that one vote to stop it. And that might be a way, for example, of addressing dissolution. It's hard for me to imagine this community agreeing 100% on that. So those community thresholds, both with respect to the powers that have been enumerated, but also with respect to these unintended powers, I think need a little more work. And I think this issue about the voting, there were a lot of questions about who gets to vote, how many votes, how the votes are allocated between different interests. This is something that the CCWG obviously worked very hard on, but it also appears to be one of the areas that's attracted the most concern in the public comments. So that seems like an area, and I just want to point out an area that maybe you want to revisit. I want to point out that you should divorce in your thinking the decision mechanism from the model used to enforce it. So, for example, if you want to stick with a model where the SOs and the ACs each pass resolutions, and once a certain number of them have passed a resolution voicing the same view, whether it's a support or objection, and then something will happen, if that's how you want the community to decide, that same mechanism could be used, whether it's in the MEM, whether it's in the sole member, or whether it were in something new like a sole designator. So the mechanism for making decisions has been questioned heavily in the public comment, but questioning that mechanism does not necessarily tell you which model of governance you should end up in. I think that it's also a little unclear how voting and consensus relate to each other, and so maybe there would be a way of talking more about when the CCWG came up with a voting model, how did you see that relating to consensus? Is it a method maybe of expressing consensus, or did you really see it as something different? Because I think that sparked some comment. On the budget, I actually don't see that much difference between the two proposals at one level, which is to say, two of the proposals on the table at least, say let's have the community have the right to object a number of times, and then after that we need to have a fallback position. We can't have the community just keep objecting forever. So that principle, everyone seems, that's the concern about paralysis. What that fallback position is, there's some difference on. Should it be current budget plus 10%? Should it be last year's budget? Should it be last year's budget plus the board has the right to make certain additions as needed? But I think that's a point of difference now, but not actually, in my mind, a point of very large difference. I think there is a little bit of difference in the enforceability level that you would get with different approaches as well. But I think if you focus more on, I'm less clear how important the enforceability is once you've already said there's going to be a fallback, once two votes have been exercised, for example. Another area of public comment, active public comment, seemed to be on the board recall. On the other hand, if that is in fact a requirement, as I think it's been framed as a requirement, either NTIA or CCWG, CWG requirements are sort of immovable, then that might be a set of public comments that you worry about less, because you know you have to have the board recall. On the individual director recall, not recall, sorry, removal of individual directors, I think there's still, there seemed to be in the public comment some question about who should have that, whether that should be a community-wide right, how it should be initiated and all that. But I think there was actually a fair amount of support, and maybe that's an area that doesn't really need to be changed. So those are just some examples, again, based on a fairly quick global view of the public comments and the email listserv communications. These issues that we've been talking about, whether you have a voting mechanism or some different way of assessing consensus, all of these issues tend to apply across the models. They're not. The difference between models probably comes down to some enforceability of certain rights, but not every single thing we're talking about, as I said, directs you into one model or the other. They're all concerns that would need to be addressed in any event. We want to come back to the point that we want to focus on the outcome and have that drive your desired outcomes, your goals, should drive the legal structure and not the legal structure, getting all caught up in the legal structure first. So it would be helpful to figure out what the accountability mechanisms and powers are and then work on how to achieve them. We still have the sense that there's some lack of clarity about what the powers are that are sought, what the accountability that is that you're seeking, how enforceable it should be. And part of the reason we keep surfacing new models and having problems with the model is that there's still some lack of agreement, I think, on the fundamental goals. And there will ultimately then be trade-offs. There's probably not a perfect solution.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Thank you very much, Holly. I see that Jenny has patiently waited for to speak.
Thank you. It was about the previous subject, so I will skip it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jenny, and apologies for haven't you waited that long. I see Sebastian Bachelet has it up. Sebastian?
Yes, I have a question. What part is legal advice? What part is your opinion? Sometimes I had the impression that you are becoming member of this group and you are saying that we may decide this way or this other. And I am a little bit puzzled with that. I really think that I would like to have clarity on what
Certainly.
Is legal advice.
Certainly. I stated at the outset that we are agnostic. We are here to help facilitate your consideration. And so you tell us what you want, and we help figure out how to structure it to get it. So we also, in doing that, need to help inform you where there are differences between approaches and what the impact of those differences are. But we do not have a view on what you should do.
Thank you very much, Holly.
I'd just like to add that, really, we do not have a view. If my client tells me enforceability is my absolute top concern and I want complete forcibility in court, that's going to lead my advice in one direction. And if they say, I'm willing to dial back on enforceability, I'm willing to go further along the trust continuum toward more of a trusting system, and I'm also concerned that with that enforceability I might get too much power, then I'm going to say, well, the model for you is this one. So we really do not have advice for you that we're hiding.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Yes, Sebastian?
I get your point, but when you say that maybe you don't need to change this model or you don't need to change the question around the board recall or board removing, sorry, but I didn't feel that it was a legal advice.
Let me clarify.
But I would like to finish also,
okay.
Because if it's a legal advice, I need to take him into account. If it's just your opinion, I need to take
no,
him into
so let
account.
Me clarify what part of that is the legal advice. The part of the legal advice there is that we think that you can address those particular concerns. We can find ways to address those concerns legally in the sole member model if that's what the community wants. What we're trying to do is let you know where there is flexibility in the law to try to find solutions. It's your decision whether or not you want recall or removal. I hope that's clear.
Thank you very much, Holly. And we have a queue. we have Cavus, Chris, and Thomas. Cavus, would you like to?
Yes, maybe concentrate at this stage only to the two models, MEM and CMSM. I raise a lot of questions in the chat. The first question is that according to the ICANN MEM, SOs only raise the issue, but not ACs, but through a resolution. It is not clear what and how the resolution will be adopted by the full consensus, by a soft consensus, or any other thing, number one. Number two, then these SO and ACs come to have a group which is called MEM issue group. In order to have MEM issue group, it is not clear whether we need to have some sort of unincorporated association or not. Something that we didn't agree with, that it took it totally away, is very, very difficult. And we don't want to come back, at least at this stage. And then it is mentioned that this MEM issue group will submit the outcome to a standing panel. Is that the standing panel the same panel as IRP, or is it a different panel? What is the decision-making of that? These are the process that we have to mention. But one important thing, ICANN MEM mentioned that the outcome should not receive any objection from AC and AC. That means one single AC could veto totally. Is it the intention that we give such a power to an AC to veto the outcome of SOs and others? So these are the questions that you raised in your memo. We raised it in our analysis. We send it to you. But we need to have a clear... Moreover, the most important, what is the legal status of this MEM issue group? Does it have a standing or does not have a standing? Thank you.
Thank
so
you.
I think those are all excellent questions and are probably better directed to the board, to members of the board who've come forward with the proposal. I agree that there's a lack of clarity. I agree that for the MEM issue group to go to court to enforce a binding arbitration, you need to address issues of standing and capacity to sue, and that could mean an unincorporated association, but there may be other ways to do it as well. I think those are issues for the board to reply to.
Thank you very much, Holly, and I would just like to get us back in focus in our discussion. While the different models might be part of the discussion, they are not the main part that we must be discussing. We should be focusing again on meeting NTIA requirements, meeting CWG requirements, and CCWG requirements. So let's not fall into this very easy to fall into trap between models. So next on the queue, I have Chris Despain.
Thank you, Leon. So I actually raised my hand to talk about something that Rosemary said, but I just want to, before I do that, I just want to make sure you don't want responses to Cavus's questions now, or you do want responses to Cavus's questions
thank you,
now?
Thank you for clarifying this, and I, as I said in the opening of this particular agenda item, we would like to, of course, get the sense of what our lawyers got into the analysis of the different comments received by not only the board but the larger community, and we will go into details later as we address each of the items in the agenda. We will be going through the IRP, the MEM, etc. But what I would like to do at this stage is to ask everyone to keep those questions in mind so that when we come to the specific point in the agenda, we can go deeper into analyzing everyone's concerns and everyone's questions. So we keep.
So that was a no.
That
was a no, which is fine. Okay. In that case, all I really wanted to say was I wanted to endorse what Rosemary said about the key is the clarity around what it is that we mean and what it is that we want. And that, to me, is the key point. instead of saying, I want the membership model or I want the mem because it gives me this, it should be, I want this, and then how can I get that? And it may well be that there are two or three or four or five different ways that you can get that. So I just wanted to endorse that comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Next, I have Thomas.
Yes, and this goes back to the question that Sebastian raised. And I'd like to say that we've asked Holly and Rosemary to provide a list of the concerns that they take from the lawyers' memos and the board papers, and also to take a look at those from a legal point of view. And what I think is quite interesting, and this is where we need their legal expertise, and that is not a matter of personal flavor, but that these are legal facts, is what concerns need to be or are present in both models or in any model, and what are concerns that relate to a specific model, and what are concerns that can be addressed under a specific model, and where are those limitations. And that will help us a great deal in getting agreement on the concerns, because concerns that exist in all models we should address anyway. This is not a matter depending on preference for one or the other model. While and if there are concerns that exist in one model which we can easily remove by tweaking that model, then we can maybe also resolve such issues. And I think this clarity is good to get from outside counsel rather than from our group members speculating over what's legally possible and what not. So I guess that's just to set the scene for this discussion. And I guess as a next step, we would like to hear from the board members that are in the room whether you think that this list of concerns that you see on the screen and which Holly spoke to, whether you think this is a finite list of concerns that you have. Does this encompass what you are concerned about?
Thank you very much, Thomas. Excellent. I have Steve Del Bianco.
Thank you. Holly and Rosemary, when you talked about the budget, you characterized it as if the membership has the statutory powers to sort of balance or override the fiduciary of the board. And then, Rosemary, you went on to suggest that there might be other means that we as a community want to do when there's a difference of opinion on budgets that would make that kind of a moot point, and I understood that. But I would ask you now, are there other requirements, such as the CWG's requirement for legal enforceability, are there other powers and requirements for which membership is uniquely positioned to deliver enforceability over a non-membership model? Thank you.
So the member model allows for direct enforcement of some of the community powers in a way that's not available under other models. And we've talked about this in the group a lot. Budget, strategy, operating plans, the review of IANA functions and that separation are all things that are difficult to give direct enforceability mechanisms around outside of a sole member model. That doesn't mean that there aren't indirect enforcement mechanisms that can be used. For example, if you have the power to recall the board, remove the board, those are a way to have indirect power on these kinds of specific issues.
One follow-up then, not being a lawyer, I need more help understanding what direct enforcement is. If CWG says that an IANA function review, if it comes up with a recommendation, needs to be legally enforceable, what does direct enforcement of that mean?
Steve, direct enforcement means that there is a person, a legal person, that actually has the ability to go to court ultimately, if all other measures fail, but it's backstopped by the ultimate ability to go to court and get a decision by a court that will be enforceable against ICANN, requiring something to happen, for example. I did want to speak briefly.
I mean, it's more than that in that we have this fiduciary issue and that, okay.
I did want to provide some clarification because I think there's been a lot in the emails and in some of the comments from the public and certainly from the board about the fiduciary duty question. The California law that ICANN is currently subject to, as Holly mentioned earlier, says that the board is in charge. The board has fiduciary duty and is responsible for overseeing the corporation. There is only one exception to that. The board's duty to oversee the corporation, the board's duty to carry out its fiduciary duties, essentially, is subject to powers that are reserved to the members. You can't reserve those powers to anyone else. The effect of a reserved power is to essentially relieve the board of the obligation with respect to that narrow decision to be in charge of the way the corporation is run. They're still going to be in charge of making it happen. But one way to think of it is that when the member exercises one of these narrow, defined, reserved powers, it essentially relieves the board of having to say, is this really the best thing for the corporation? And I would want to note that there is, in the discussion of fiduciary duty, I also think there's been a little bit of blurring between the best interests of ICANN, the corporation, and the global public interest. ICANN's mission is to operate in the global public interest, but I don't think you can necessarily collapse what's in the global public interest with what's in ICANN's best interest, especially in the shorter run, when ICANN might have financial issues that affect it that would mean it needs to do something that maybe isn't at that moment the best thing in furtherance of the global public interest. So there is some tension there that the board has to resolve whenever they're trying to make sure that ICANN stays on mission but also do what's best for the corporation, which can be affected by all sorts of external things. So this concept that the member allows you to relieve the board of fiduciary duty with respect to these narrow reserve powers also has a corollary, which is, well, if the board's relieved of fiduciary duty, who has fiduciary duty? And the answer is, with respect to narrow reserved powers, nobody. And I think that's a real concern that has been voiced. And then the question is, I think really as a legal matter, do you trust the members with respect to those narrow powers that they are reserving and taking away potentially from the board? Do you trust them as a whole, whether it's a sole member or many, many, many members, to do what's best for the corporation through some sort of community consensus or voting process?
And so that's one of the reasons why on the budget the notion was a veto to send back to the board twice to express concern, but then to have the ability for the board to still come to some decision.
Very much. So we have a queue, of course, and I just want to make sure I have some hands in the AC room that might be new or old. I just want to get to you, Steve Del Bianco. Okay, you've lowered your hand, so next on the queue is Chris Despain.
Thank you. It seems that we are actually discussing, despite our best efforts, we are actually discussing the models, but I have some questions or some comments for Holly and Rosemary. On the direct enforceability point, it's correct, isn't it, that in the case of the sole member, it's necessary that one or two individuals stand as the legal person within that sole member, and that is the equivalent of having in the MEM one or two persons or the chairs of SOs and ACs, merely as examples, stand as legal persons in order to bring a binding arbitration. Those two things are equivalents, it seems to me. Is that not correct?
I don't think they're quite equivalents, the sole member would be organized as an unincorporated association. Yes, it does need a human being or two to actually act, but those people are only acting on behalf of the unincorporated association. It wasn't clear to me that in the MEM you had an unincorporated association, or whether you were asking the chairs to actually be the people named as the plaintiffs taking action. In a sole member context, it would be the member that would be the plaintiff going to court and not the individual.
So if it's not clear, just let me make it clear that it would be entirely a matter for the SOs and ACs to decide. It seems to me that whichever way around you look at it, you need real people. Even if you've got an unincorporated association, you still need real people in order to make that unincorporated association legal. So I don't mean individual people, I mean legal people. So whichever way around you look at it, you need those. My point is that, yes, you're correct. I don't think our proposal says it could be an unincorporated association, but clearly it could be. The difference, it seems to me, is that in this specific context I'm talking about, there are other differences. In this context, the difference is simply that in the case of the sole member model, you create the entity that has the enforceability power now and keep it there for all time. And in the case of the MEM, you create the entity that has the enforceability power as and when you need it, in order to bring that enforcement. That's in essence the difference, I think. On this, I guess there are lots of other differences, but on this specific issue. Now, I've got a couple of other points, and I apologize if I'm taking up too much time.
Can I respond on that?
Sorry, Rosemary. Yes.
Before you go, I'm sorry. I think I agree with much of what you said. However, I think the question of when the unincorporated association that's going to potentially be the complainant, when it arises, could actually affect standing and capacity to sue, because I'm not sure that an entity that came into being after the complaint arose, after the wrong, the claim arose, is going to have standing. So I have a little bit of concern. But that would be easily fixed in the MEM approach by just saying we're going to create it ahead of time.
Yeah, it depends on at what point you create it, but I agree. But I think you're right, that can be fixed. I just have one other point, really, which is just the point you made about reserving powers and the fiduciary duty. Is it not correct that the board can, in fact, agree to be bound by arbitration, and that on that basis there isn't, in fact, that much of a difference between the reserving the power to the member. I mean, on those narrow number of things. Because this may be wrong, but the way you said it was the only way you can do that is through a membership model. But it seems to me that you can do that through binding arbitration.
No, I don't believe that you can. I believe that binding arbitration can only be available for areas in which the board could otherwise be bound in its fiduciary duty. So that's one of the reasons, and I think it's recognized actually in the Q&A, the FAQs from the board about the concerns that binding arbitration is also subject to some of this limitation.
Okay, I'll pick that up. I'll pick that up on the list and come back on that, because that's not my understanding, but I'll check it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So we still have some people in the queue. I want to note that after Cavus, we have Nigel Roberts, who is not in the AC room, just for the record. And at this point, we are very short in time, so we will be beginning using the timer, the two-minute timer. So next on the queue is Cavus. Cavus, please go ahead.
Thank you. I suggest that we concentrate and address one issue at a time, but don't go to many other issues. Budgets, leave it, discuss it later. We are concentrating on the MEM and the CMSM and to see the deficiencies and how we would reply to that. If we entail many other issues, it will be difficult because they are so interconnected. So let us concentrate on one issue at a time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. Next is Nigel Roberts. Can we have a mic for Nigel, please? Yeah, and reset the clock, of course.
Thank you. I'm just going to make this very quick anyway, so I don't think you'd have needed to reset the clock. I've been a member of a board of a non-profit organization, national one in England. I know a little bit about how these things are set up, and it seems we're coming at this exactly in the wrong direction. We talk about fiduciary. A fiduciary is somebody who is trusted and, by the members. When you incorporate something, it's normally, and this is not the case in ICANN, but it's normally the case that some people get together for a common purpose. It's the same as when you incorporate a corporation. And what we have is a situation where we're trying to retrofit something, and we're saying, well, we don't kind of have any members in ICANN. And for certain purposes of holding the board to account, we kind of need to have some members. So we're talking in terms of the board giving, trusting the membership with certain reserve powers. The place I come from is that when you come together, it is the members of an organization that have every power, and then they trust the board with the day-to-day management of the corporation and give them fiduciary responsibility. And I think partly this is where some of this is coming from. If we had gone, if we'd kept ICANN 1.0, and gone to an actual membership model where every single person who participated in ICANN became a member, your source of legitimacy and your source of authority is obvious. I'm not offering a solution here. I'm just trying to point out something that of why we could possibly be going around in circles at some point.
Thank you very much, Nigel. Next on the queue, I have Jordan, and I just want to note that we have closed the queue with Greg Shutton. So, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan Carter, .nz, for the record. I just wanted to come back to the direct versus indirect enforcement and a way this was described in Paris, which I think might help people just get their heads around it. The way it was discussed there was to say that if you were, the direct enforceability of the powers under the membership model is clear, you know, there's a nice clear line of accountability if the board doesn't do the thing, if a director doesn't remove themselves when they've been dismissed by the SO or whatever, in the end the organization can go to court. Without a membership model, to the extent that some of those powers aren't directly enforceable, the indirect enforceability means that you might have to do something else to make people do it. So if there's a designator model and you could enforce the removal of a director, if the community power to say no to a budget was ignored by the board, you can't do anything about that budget direction being ignored, but you can remove the director. So I think that's what's meant by indirect enforcement of the community powers here. So I thought that one of the reasons, and again, like Chris, I'm risking talking about the models, that we ended up with a member model in both of our draft proposals so far was that there was a nice, clean, simple line of enforcement here. So I just hope that helps people get their heads around it.
Thank you very much, Jordan. Next in the queue, Avri Doria.
Thank you. Avri Doria speaking. I have a question which I think is a clarification on this discussion we're having about fiduciary responsibility and removing it or overruling it. And in the way I was looking at it, except perhaps in the case of the removal of board directors, which I believe is probably the least of the powers we're talking about because it's so impossible to use, that in most of them we're only asking for sharing that responsibility, in that in all of the instances there's no replacement of the board's fiduciary responsibility. There's a working with the board, the community, and the board to come to a determination. It's working together to approve a fundamental bylaw. Both have to. It's working together. So I have a certain amount of difficulty when the conversation switches to removing that fiduciary responsibility, because except in their own removal, I don't see the proposal as doing that. It's just a sharing of responsibility on a few particular instances. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Avri. I think you want to react to that, Holly or Rosemary.
I'm not sure if we agree, but so feel free to contradict me. I think that's right, Avery. And I think when we were using that example of the override, we were talking about the extreme. But in order to even share powers in the area of a budget, we think that it's a clearer ability to do that through the member organization.
My response builds on Holly's rather than contradicting it, fortunately. This is Rosemary Fay. And now I'm going to get pretty granular. The board proposal says that if there's two rejections, then the board can adopt a budget that is plus 10%. The CCWG proposal says after two rejections by the community, then automatically the budget that's in place is last year's budget. And I'm not getting into all the details there, but that's fundamentally on the budget. The concern I have, where this membership versus non-membership rubber really hits the road, is whether that bylaw that says, and after two rejections, the board shall adopt a budget that provides for no more than 10% increase, whether that bylaw, which the board is proposing to put in, so they're agreeing to constrain their powers, but I'm concerned that it could be unenforceable because, in fact, maybe what's really needed is a 12% increase, and in the exercise of their fiduciary duties, they decide, you know, we agreed to this bylaw, we agreed to 10%, but it's just not going to work. It's not in the best interest of the corporation. We can't vote for it. We're going for 11%. And now the question is, how do you is the bylaw enforceable or not?
Good. That was the two-minute timer. Thanks. Okay, so next we have Greg Chatan, and we will be closing the queue with him. Sebastian, I am mindful that you have your hand raised, but I would just like to call for your comprehension, and you will be the first to speak after the break. So, Greg, please.
Thanks, Greg Chatan, for the record. Concerned with an underlying issue here as we talk about fiduciary duties, and recognize that there are duties other than fiduciary duties. And when we're looking at the power that a member would have or could have, and they are narrow powers that would be given to the multi-stakeholder community, there seems to be a concern that the multi-stakeholder community somehow has no duties, has no judgment, has no it's kind of like this untamed beast, and we're going to, you know, give it the keys to the car, at least in some narrow fashion. I have a little bit more optimism about the multi-stakeholder community. I also think we need to explore, as we said, both how to constrain those powers and how to define the duties, or at least the process and procedures and the ability would be exercised, which I think altogether would provide a pathway and a controlled logical way for the member to act. So contrasting the board with its fiduciary duties with a member that can act like a 2-year-old and throw all its toys out of the crib, I think is not the compare and contrast in my mind. So I would ask that we do think about how a member is constrained both statutorily and in however we set up the member. And I think we should be able to come up with something that would make everyone quite comfortable that the member is at least as grown up as the board. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. And this takes me to, of course, back to the slide that we have on our screen. And I would like to just go through it so we have agreement that these are the points that we should be focusing in while advancing our discussion later in the agenda on each of the items that we're going to discuss. We need to address, of course, the degree of change. That is a very valid concern that has been raised. Some might think of our proposal as it stands as a very complex solution. This might be fixed, I think. And so having in mind this, we should definitely try to discuss and find a way to address this concern on degree of change. The second one being the degree of experience and community preparedness to take on a new role. So this adds to what Greg just said. I think we have a very mature community that would be able to handle its responsibilities in front of the wider internet community and the multi-stakeholder community. So having in mind that we already have a baseline and we won't be starting from scratch, of course, let's make it so that we can address this concern in our proposal. Then how to ensure SOs and ACs are accountable. This is, of course, another very valid concern. It's been widely discussed within our group. It might not be properly reflected still in our proposal, but I can assure you that this is something that we have taken very seriously in the course of our work. We have spoken to our advisors. Our advisors have provided us with great advice on how to tackle this issue too. So, okay, that's the 2 minutes. So, no. Then the next point would be how should community decisions be made? This will be addressed when we speak about community forum, about how we would be trying to coming to a solution that addresses this concern on how decisions would be made. Of course, this deals also with voting allocation of power. The questions about is it sufficiently inclusive? Is influence diminished for the GAC? These are all concerns that we have heard and we will be assessing as we move forward in the agenda later today. Another very valid concern is, of course, to avoid any paralysis to the board. We don't want a board that is hand-tied, but we also want a board that is accountable to the community. We don't want to break with fiduciary duties of the board, and as I said, we don't want them to bind the hands under fiduciary duties as well. Then how do we ensure statutory powers are properly constrained? So this is something we need to carefully assess and discuss, continue discussion. And finally, how do we ensure that the community powers are enforceable without leading to undue litigation? And that is, I think, a concern that's been raised by many in the public comment. How do we ensure that we keep the safeguards or the appropriate safeguards so that any powers that we vest into the community are not abused against the community itself or the board or the wider internet community. I don't know, if Thomas, if you want to add something to what I just said.
This is Thomas. We'd just like to ask whether this accurately reflects the underlying concerns. So are these the questions that the board has? Are these the concerns that the board has? You know, we said we wanted to step away from the models, although some of us couldn't resist discussing models, and it was good to have some questions asked and answered surrounding that, but I think we need to capture the concerns. This is our take, our lawyer's take, on what the board's concerns are. So can we agree that these concerns need to be addressed? Or are we missing something? So hopefully after these 2 days, we will be able to tick the concerns off the list. There's a hand up by Steve and then George.
Thank you. Sorry, it's faster to do this than to go to the Adobe room. You know, in the interest of of clarity and consistency. I think that we tried, from the board's perspective, to write out our concerns, and we supplied them in the response that we gave to the second proposal. So those comments still stand. We've tried subsequently in various ways to make them more compact and to solidify them a bit. But the question of what are the concerns that the board has had with the proposal, I think we did lay out. Happy to go through them again, but that would be the base that we start with.
I think the difficulty is that we sort of need to come up with main topics or the concerns that the board has in order to see how we can address them. You know, just pointing to like 200 pages of documentation will be very difficult to address in this
No, I wasn't talking about the 200 pages. I was talking about a much more compact half dozen pages, I think, that we sent. We can sort that out.
Yes, maybe you can. But the suggestions that you made in the papers and then the comparison chart do address concerns. So you're coming up with suggestions because you have concerns, and we're trying to understand the concerns, as we try to understand the concerns from other commenters, and we want to remove concerns. George.
Thank you, Thomas. I think everything that's been said is helpful toward the discussion, but I'd like to take a slightly higher level view, and this may be silly, but I feel it fairly strongly. I can't help but feel that we are fighting a proxy war here, and that the concerns about these extreme cases that we're talking about, what happens if the board goes rogue, what happens if the community goes rogue, et cetera, are more manifestations of a fundamental destruction of trust or lack of trust or low level of trust in the entire community. And that no matter how we settle the CCWG accountability, we are going to, unless we solve the trust problem, these problems will continue. I think we're dealing with symptoms and not root causes here. We may need to do it this way, but I think that I wanted to highlight that feeling of that there's a fundamental problem we're not ignoring, but not addressing directly here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. And this makes me come back a little bit to the open source software approach. Remember that when you use open software, you rely on trusting that the copyright holder won't sue you for that. So I think we need to trust each other in any approach we take in our solution. So do you want to?
No, I was just about to suggest that we break for lunch now. Obviously,
no, not lunch.
Break for coffee. You want to answer the question?
I want to answer the question you asked about this list, or rather address that first, if that's okay.
Yes. We have Mike and we have Fadi still on the queue, and finally Mark Revelle. And after that, we will go into the break.
So yes, the answer is yes. This covers a number of the points that we raised. What's kind of missing is the timing thing. It doesn't matter if you want to fight with me about the words, but let's call it ICANN 3.0. It's that we are making fundamental. So it's kind of covered by the degree of change, but that implies there is a problem with the change per se. And actually, there may not be a problem with the change per se. The problem is ramming it through in such a quick period of time. And one of the reasons why the board was so careful to try to provide a basis for the future continuing improvement, the new ways to get to ICANN 3.0, was precisely that. It's about what's happening now within the confines of what we have to do. And it is, in fact, in my personal view, and I think probably in the view of the board, it is a big pushback against the statements that have been made from the very beginning of this, which is, this is our chance, this is our leverage, if we don't do it now, we'll never get it. Frankly, that is nonsense, and the board's view is very strongly that if we go about this slowly, step by step, we ask the question simply, what do we need to get done in order to get the transition through? And we all agree
that the time has come for ICANN to move to its next iteration. You know, it's already done it twice, and there is a process in place to make that happen. That, I think, is the essence of the board's position that is not covered by the words on that list. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think at this point it would just be unfair to continue to hold Sebastian in the queue. So, Sebastian, could you please? Okay, thank you for agreeing on that. So next in the queue I have Mike.
Thanks. I was actually going to offer Sebastian my place in the queue because the queue was closed and then Thomas raised a question without dealing with the previous interventions. But seeing as Sebastian waved it forward, let me say, Thomas, I think that you're asking the wrong question. This is not an engagement between the CCWG and the board. My understanding is that this is a meeting of the CCWG. Just there are more board members that are present and the board has submitted substantive comments. But I think there are comments that have come across from all the community. And I would really encourage you, instead of saying, well, is this the comprehensive list of the board's comments? Are these the only issues and we deal with the board? That's not what we're here to do. We're here to try and identify, and I'd like to go back to what Holly was saying. What are we trying to solve for and what are appropriate models? Have there been concerns raised? Can those be resolved? Should we rethink some of these issues? So, yes, this is some of the board's issues. There's also some of the community's issues. But there are other issues raised by the board and by the community, some more important, some less important. But I think that your approach of saying, is this the board's list, is totally the wrong way of going about this. Let's rather look at what is needed and address all people's issues, not just the fact that you have a couple of board members or a couple more board members in the room suddenly turns this into a dialogue between the CCWG and the board. I'm not hearing consensus among the CCWG on these issues either. I'm hearing a lot of people saying, well, we can solve for it. And I'm just saying, let's change the dialogue, please, because this is this the list and now let's go into a negotiation is not going to be helpful.
Mike, just before we move to the next speaker in the queue, to make this perfectly clear, we have received comments from others that we could analyze in a fashion that we really had a finite list of the other commenters' concerns. There was a lot of communication between the board and the CCWG, and it is at least our impression as a leadership team that we haven't been able to fully grasp the board's concerns. And since the board is a stakeholder in this community, which is true, but it has a special role in that it has to pass on these recommendations to NTIA, we want to make sure that we fully understand what the board's concerns are. That's the purpose of the exercise. That is why we sort of put it in front of the bracket. And as we continue to move through the various sections of our report, you will find that we will speak to the concerns raised by the whole community and not only by the board. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for that clarification. I think it's very useful. Next is Mark Carvel.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and good morning, everybody. Mark Carvel, United Kingdom representative on the GAC. I think it is a very helpful list. It helps us to focus. My reason for taking the floor is with respect to the fifth bullet in relation to the GAC. I think it doesn't quite give the full story of the board's concern in relation to the GAC, because as I understood it, the board did have reservations about how the proposal would shift the role of the GAC into a more operational function by participating in voting mechanisms and so on. So, I mean, that's certainly an issue for the GAC, but I do recall the board expressing that concern, and that would have wider political ramifications as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I think we can now go to our coffee break, and we will come back, of course, to deepen the discussion in what we have just put into this list. And I think that's a very valid clarification, and we will go into that, Mark, when we will be reviewing, of course, the GAC role and how we want to or how we could address those concerns raised not only by the board but of course by many members in the GAC and by the wider community. So just that is definitely something we will be discussing. So we will have a break and we will be reconvening in minus 30 minutes as per the schedule. So okay, so it is a 15-minute break, so enjoy.